You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
Journalist Julia Cook's work has been seen in Condé Nast Traveler, The New York Times, Playboy, The Village Voice, and lots of other places. She's the author of The Other Side of Paradise, Life in the New Cuba, and a great new book that I really love called Come Fly the World, The Jet Age Story of the Women of Pan Am. And she joins us now. Julia Cook, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me.
I really remember well the era of the stewardess, and it was really kind of fun to fly. And it was a very different era of flying, for sure.
It was a totally different time.
Now flying is an ordeal.
Yeah, it is. Back then, it was an occasion. It was something that was really undertaken, not very frequently by most people. And it was really an occasion. It was something to celebrate, something to look forward to, which, you know, the airlines really helped cultivate that air of an event, because they were they couldn't compete back in that time period on the basis of prices. So they all competed on the basis of image and experience.
Well, in the earlier era of train travel, all of the porters on a train were all African-American men named George. They all called him George. And yet the airlines decided not to emulate that, but to try something different. How did they come up with the idea, and why did they come up with the idea of steward eye?
So they did not, in fact, come up with the idea. A woman named Ellen Church came up with the idea in the 20s. She was a pilot and a nurse, and she was really determined to get into the air, to have a career in the air. Flying was new, and men had been the stewards on planes up until then. They were really following the model of trains to some extent. But Ellen Church approached a United Airlines executive when she saw him on the ground in San Francisco, actually. And she said, you know what, I've got an idea. You should hire nurses. You're flying in the weather. Everyone's getting airsick all the time. They are afraid of this new technology, so they're going to need reassurance. And who better to tackle both of those things than a nurse who is competent and reassuring and you know, able to handle the sickness. And the man then turned around, the executive then turned around and made the case to his board that you know, really, women would be better suited to serve the mostly male clientele that was then flying. They would be better able to reassure a male passenger. A man wouldn't find it, he could get competitive with another man trying to make him feel better if he was sick or find it like an affront to his masculinity. But a woman would really be able to help him. And beyond that, the fact that girls were flying, I say girls pretty, ironically, but would reassure the passengers, and it would speak to the safety of the airplane itself. So
then, if girls were willing to do it, then you should be willing to do it.
There's this amazing quote from the Atlantic Monthly: "If a mere girl isn't worried, then why should a passenger be?"
A mere girl.
I love it.
So let me just ask you this question, because yes, there's a lot of sexism that surrounds this whole idea of the stewardess. And it's, I know that the world is a much better place today for having equal opportunity, where there's at least an awareness of sexism, if not the elimination of it. But am I wrong in thinking that maybe there was something that has been lost
I don't think you're wrong. Look, one of the things that I found so interesting about this group of women was that it's almost a bittersweet. One of the things that I found so intriguing about this group of women was that their desire to get out into the world, which was not a female domain. You know, keep in mind that before the 60s, it was really not not socially acceptable for a woman to travel alone without a chaperone or without, a lot of money and a high class status that she could kind of trade on to excuse her travels. It was not seen as a socially acceptable thing. It was not something that good girls did. And so, you know, these women had been so determined in a really revolutionary sort of way to get out into the world, to not listen to that, social conscience or whatever you want to call it. And so they were willing to really adhere to this very feminine norm just to gain access to the whole globe. And they did, and they changed, you know, that desire and that determination to then keep their job, because the constraints of the job were really very sexist. The women had to quit when they got married. They had to adhere to these really strict grooming requirements, weight requirements, the weight checks. It was pretty,
how much could they weigh? There was a, was that because you couldn't carry so much weight on a plane, or because they didn't?
I mean, it was much more about them needing to remain attractive for the men, because as I said, the airlines couldn't compete on the basis of price. So they had to compete via image, and these stewardesses were a huge part of their image. So they used these women as kind of a lure for the male passengers in a really blatant way sometimes. But so these women were, you know, they wound up, their desire to keep their job, no matter what they weighed, no matter whether they were married or not, no matter how old they were, really changed the industry. And it made it much more equal. Obviously, like, you're right, it's a much better workplace now than it was back then, for in very, very, very many ways. However, one of the things was that it really, back then, it was a lot of women that I talked to found a degree of solace in this feminine domain. They really met a lot of kindred spirits, a lot of other women that they wound up remaining lifelong friends with. And so, you know, with diversity comes a little bit of a loss of that.
So what about race? What were the, I know in your book, you talk about a lot of Black women had gone to stewardess training, and then they couldn't get a job even though they were highly qualified.
Yeah, it was deeply, deeply racist at the beginning, certainly. Yes, they hired, again, there are some really appalling quotes that I came across, which I personally feel uncomfortable even saying aloud. It was a very racist workplace at first. And there were lawsuits that the NAACP brought on behalf of a number of really intrepid and determined women who had gone to these stewardess schools and just watched as the white women who graduated alongside them were offered these jobs, and their letters never came. And so they brought lawsuits against the airlines, and thanks to the EEOC, and the rulings therein, the airlines were then forced to start, you know, diversifying their hiring, as well they should have. A lot of really fascinating women who had been so determined to get out into the world wound up flying for a lot of really interesting airlines.
When African American stewardesses came on board, did they find resistance from white stewardesses?
Some resistance from white stewardesses. My book focuses on the women of Pan Am. And, you know, I definitely heard stories about some pretty both blatant racism and then just what we would today call microaggressions. But I also heard a lot about women who generally felt like everyone, you know, a lot of their coworkers really were curious about the rest of the world and curious about them, curious about people who weren't necessarily like them. And so again, like I do think that almost in the same way that like a girls' school, people talk about, you know, what all girls' schools are like, you know, that's kind of how a lot of the women that I talked to spoke about stewardessing in the era before men became more prevalent on the airlines as well.
I was really surprised to learn in your book, Come Fly the World, how trained the stewardesses were. I mean, they could basically fly the plane.
It was incredible. One of the best pieces of my research. I loved you know, just leafing through these, their training manuals. Their training manuals are incredible documents because they spent 6 weeks in training, and they learned about things that ranged from the physics of flight. They needed to be able to explain the actual mechanics and physics of how a plane moved through the air to a passenger, because according to Pan Am's, you know, the higher ups at Pan Am, at least, they said that first time, a lot of that on every flight, they would certainly, you know, be meeting a first time flyer, and they needed to be able to, you know, assuage that flyer's anxiety with logic and fact. But then they also had to learn about, you know, what color lipstick worked best with their complexion or their eye shape, what color, you know, what kind of eyeliner to apply for their eye shape, and how to prepare a highball. And they also, one of the things that fascinated me about the training was, its focus on diplomacy. That word is just, appears over and over and over again in their training manuals. They learned about, you know, the culinary traditions of different countries that they were flying to. They learned about, you know, the different cultural, a lot of the cultural differences, because they were really expected to give a dignified service to people, no matter where they were coming from, no matter where they were going to. It was supposed to be, they were supposed to be really knowledgeable about all of these different things.
I loved it when you told me in your book that they gave instructions in two languages, not because the people on the plane didn't speak one language, but because they thought it would be better to do it in two languages. It would be.
Yeah, they came right out and said it. It's showmanship. They said, you know, we wanted, they basically said that they wanted their passengers to feel, I mean, it's exactly like we were saying, a sense of occasion, from the moment they stepped onto a plane, and that their vacation was beginning, as soon as they got on the plane. And part of that was language.
Well, of course, there was a lot less, a lot less security. I mean, I remember going to the airport and just like getting a ticket and walking on a plane without anybody checking anything, not like now, where you have to count on at least an hour of going through security. And was that ever a problem that you encountered from your interviews?
No, security was not a huge, it was not a huge thing back then. You know, and almost to the point where, you know, I heard more stories about really, truly dangerous things that were happening in the air, and that that the women were expected to be able to handle. Again, that was one of the things that really fascinated me about this subject from the first minute that I started researching it. You know, one of the things that drew me to the subject was that when I met a couple of former Pan Am stewardesses almost by accident. And I was fascinated by them because they seemed to really embody this duality of both glamour and grit. They were really sophisticated, but they were also incredibly smart and savvy. And, you know, they were really, they had both of those things. And, you know, of course that duality was, some of it's just inborn. It's just who they were, but some of it was cultivated by this airline that required them to really appear, you know, effortless, but then also be able to handle, you know, for example, on Pan Am, they flew a lot of Vietnam War flights. They had to be able to handle a soldier with PTSD who was behaving really erratically and violently in the air. They had to be able to, you know, keep their cool if a hijacker was trying to take the plane to Cuba. So that, you know, they were almost the security.
And hijackings were kind of, I mean, did you talk to stewardesses who had in fact been on hijacked planes?
None of my primary subjects were on a hijacked plane, but one of them was almost on a hijacked plane. And she was really, she wished that she had been on this hijacked plane, because for a brief period of time in the late 60s and early 70s, hijackings were seen as almost a novelty. They had not yet been, there had been no fatalities yet. And they happened really at a pretty brisk clip. And often they wound up flying their passengers to Cuba, where they would spend a night, oftentimes, and, you know, be treated to a cabaret, and some drinks, and
darn, I didn't back. Get a check.
Yeah, I know. Truly. She told me that she was supposed to be on a plane, on a shuttle from JFK to Puerto Rico. And, she was told that another woman was going to take her place on the shuttle, and she was going to wait for the one that was leaving an hour later, and crew that one. And they were in the air somewhere over, I think, South Carolina. And the pilot called her into the cockpit and say, "Hey, you, weren't you supposed to be on flight? I think it was 281. And she said, "Yeah, I was." And he said, "Lucky you, you just missed it. It's heading to Cuba." And she was like, Damn.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf, and we're talking this week with Julia Cook. She's the author of Come Fly the World, the Jet Age Story of the Women of Pan Am. Right before the break, we were talking about hijacking planes to Cuba.
Well, you've written extensively about Cuba as well. What was it about Cuba that led to hijackings?
Well, a lot of it was the political atmosphere. You know, this was the Cold War, and this was the late 60s. And there were a lot of, communist sympathizers in the U.S. certainly, who wanted to get down to Fidel.
So it was just a way to get a trip somewhere that you couldn't get because.
Exactly. Yeah. The embargo had already been put in place, and so they couldn't get there really otherwise. And it was a dramatic event. If anyone's interested in hijacking, there's another really good book by a guy named Brennan Corner called The Skies Belong to Us about the golden age of hijacking, which is fascinating.
The golden age of hijacking.
Yeah, I know. It doesn't really, the term itself is interesting.
There was also some kind of mixed signals being sent about stewardesses by the media, which, of course, the airlines participated in as well. I mean, you mentioned in your book the movie that I like, Boeing, with Tony Curtis and Jerry Lewis and Thelma Ritter, where Tony Curtis is a playboy who has girlfriends who are all stewardesses, and they come based on their schedule, and they... Oh, it's a funny picture. I think it was a Broadway show, if I'm not mistaken.
It was, yeah. It was super popular in London.
Yeah. And then there was also Coffee, Tea, and Me, the book that was very ubiquitous paperback around in those days. Everybody had a dog-eared copy with certain pages marked. and I guess the worst of it was I'm Cheryl, Fly Me.
Totally. Yeah. So basically, you know, in the late 60s, what started happening was that, you know, these women who had this access to the world and who were really worldly and flying around and, you know, keep in mind, this is the sexual revolution. It became a trope, aided along or kind of, you know, exploded. It exploded out of Coffee, Tea, or Me on some level, which was supposedly written by two stewardesses for Eastern Airlines, when in reality, it was written by a man named Donald Bain. He was an American Airlines PR flack. And he had met these two women who he described in pretty sexist terms. And he you know, decided that they started talking, I think, at Toots Shores in New York. And he, you know, they told him some stories and they said, we should write a book. It's really interesting. Being a stewardess is just the best. We love our jobs. And then he took it from there. So the whole book is really a figment of the male imagination. It is not, and it bears not that much, it's not that close to reality. And so from there, the airlines, who had always competed on the basis of, their stewardesses' glamour and attractiveness, really began overtly sexualizing its stewardesses. And, you know, to the point where some of the ads, said things along the lines of, you know, everyone's going to walk away with a good flight experience, and some of you may walk away with a wife. And, you know, there's the I'm Cheryl, Fly Me campaign for National Airlines. And, you know, the list goes on. I've got a whole ton of them in the book and on social media. It just became that pop culture image of kind of the, stewardesses who were in it, who were interested in the job for dates and for shopping, and really for sex, came to almost eclipse the image of the women who were actually working as stewardesses, you know, some of whom, sure, they went on dates with some of their passengers or with expats that they met abroad. They did what they wanted to. They were liberated women, but many more of them were also really, really interested in the job for its cultural offerings and for their ability to travel and to participate in really interesting, and important flights to be able to see the global art capitals of the world, or to be able to, you know, they all had their own agendas, their own reasons for wanting to fly. And some of them really did enjoy the sex and the shopping, but many more of them had much more serious aims.
Well, Julia Cook, in the book Come Fly the World, we learned a lot about the women that were stewardesses and how they became stewardesses. And you had several that you met and interviewed. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your cast of characters?
Yeah, sure. So my book focuses on five women. There are three who are very, very central, and their names are Tori, Karen, and Lynn. They all wound up on one really important flight in 1975 out of Saigon called Operation Baby Lift, which was a flight to bring back some almost 400 children out of Vietnam and children and infants days before Vietnam fell to the North Vietnamese. So in each of them, they're very different women. They all joined Pan Am for the same reason. They wanted to see the world. Almost every woman I've ever interviewed about flying for Pan Am told me a variation on that phrase, that they signed up to fly because they wanted to see the world. But their desire to see the world really came out of very different personal goals. Tori had really wanted to be a diplomat, but she was faced with some pretty, you know, back then the diplomatic corps of almost every world country was an entirely male domain, and women had to quit if they got married, if they were accepted at all. Lynn had been a scientist. She graduated college with a science degree, but really didn't like, she found herself pretty alienated both by the isolation of the lab work and also by, you know, the men who were kind of intimidating, when she was surrounded by them. She was always the only woman in the lab. And Karen, who had been, who is, you know, she's pretty, she's wonderful. She's almost bohemian-ish in her outlook. She does what she wants to do. She's from California. She loves hiking and skiing, and was pretty widely traveled when she signed up for Pan Am. She had tried to get a teaching job, and she had gotten a teaching job. She'd tried to stay in a teaching job and found it really, kind of boring. She much preferred to be able to travel. So she, signed up for Pan Am for that reason. And then there are two other women, Claire, who began flying in the 50s and who was incredibly senior and was really determined to work in management, and did wind up eventually working in management. And then Hazel Bowie, who's an African-American woman from Minnesota, who was, again, totally determined to get out of the Midwest. That was her primary goal in life. She signed up for, she was going to apply for a bunch of different airlines, and Pan Am was the first that hired her.
How did you find these women, and what did they think when you said, I want to write a book about your experiences?
I found them via an organization called World Wings International, which is kind of an alumni organization for former Pan Am crew. It's pretty active. They have a yearly conference that happens all around the world, and it attracts like 200 to 700 attendees who, you know, are these women who are in their, you know, 60s to 90s who still travel together, which I found remarkable. They you know, the strength of their friendships was one of the things that first struck me about these women, and the degree to which they're still so daring. I met a woman who was in her mid-70s at an event who told me, oh dear, I never buy a return ticket from anywhere because you never know what's going to happen. and I just loved her from that moment on. But that's how I mostly found them. And you know, a lot of them were really excited to talk to me, mostly because I think a lot of people have asked them about, you know, what celebrities they flew with on Pan Am, or, you know, where they had bought the most interesting things, or, you know, they'd been asked about anecdotes that had to do with this kind of pop cultural image that stewardesses had back then. But not that many people had asked them about, you know, what did you do that kind of looked like diplomacy, you know, or, you know, what were the war flights like in Vietnam? Not many people knew that, or still today know that all American troops that flew out to Vietnam were carried by civilian airplanes, which means that there were, you know, women who were conceived of and hired for their beauty. And they were put in these incredibly dangerous situations, and you know, really participated alongside the men who had been drafted into the war in that era. So, you know, not many people had really asked them about these much grittier sides of their experiences. So a lot of them were really, really keen to talk about it.
When the planes landed in Vietnam, they could only stay on the ground for like the briefest period of time so they wouldn't get shot. Were there incidents?
Yeah, there were, I definitely heard about, you know, planes coming under fire, women having to hide out behind barricades, you know, landing and finding bullet holes in the belly of the plane. And, you know, keep in mind that in that era, there was one CIA officer was quoted as saying that Pan Am was more recognizable around the world as a symbol of America than Coca-Cola was. So the Pan Am logo on the side of a plane was, it was a target.
And the women often didn't want to fly away right away. They wanted to see their soldiers in. They had taken a kind of a proprietary view of them.
They did. Yeah. You know, a lot of the women that I talked to, they had very varied perspectives on the war itself. I talked to some women who really appreciated contributing to what they saw as a just war effort. And then I talked to a lot of women who were very anti-war, who were active in the protest movement. But the thing that united all of these women was that they really felt very strongly that that the people on their planes, that the men, the soldiers on their planes, deserved the utmost dignity and support, that a lot of these men did not want to be there either, because of the draft. And, they did that some of them would not be coming home, and they felt very, very keenly that, the responsibility that they had to offer, a moment of levity or dignity or, you know, humanity.
We're talking with Julia Cook, and her new book is called Come Fly the World, The Jet Age Story of the Women of Pan Am. Tell me a little bit about the evolving uniforms that the stewardesses wore. And I mean, I can remember an era where they had to wear hot pants, or I don't know if they considered having to wear hot pants, or what, how did they deal with their uniforms and how did they feel about them?
A lot of the different airlines dealt with it very differently. So on Pan Am, which is what my book primarily deals with, the uniforms were always pretty conservative, because keep in mind that, you know, the sexual revolution was not happening the same way in every city in the world that Pan Am was flying to. So, you know, they maintained a relatively professional, a very professional and relatively almost militaristic line sometimes. They were designed by the couturiers of the day. On other airlines, though, they definitely the hemlines got a lot shorter over the course of the 60s, culminating in the hot pants of Southwest Airlines in the early 70s. But a lot of the different airlines really pushed the limits of respectability as far as women's attire goes.
How did the Pan Am stewardesses feel about what they were wearing?
Yes, they loved it. You know, a lot of these women really felt like the starched shoulders and the tailored look of their uniforms felt dignified to them, and they felt like it gave them authority on their planes.
So what role, even though this was like an incredibly sexist thing as we look back on it, what role in the development of feminism do you think that stewardesses played?
So two things. On a really factual level, that they played a huge role in that, in the 60s and 70s, late 60s primarily, their desire to keep their jobs propelled them to keep their jobs beyond getting married or, you know, the age limits that airlines imposed on them, propelled them into courtrooms and spurred legal battles to keep their jobs. So they really brought some of the lawsuits against airlines and against sexist hiring policies that set the legal precedent for a lot of the gender-based labor discrimination laws that that followed. So that contributed overtly. But I think less examined is the role that they played just getting out into the world. You know, these were women who, you know, many tens of thousands of them who were traveling by themselves. They were making paychecks. They were collecting per diem from the company to pay for their tourism or their, you know, explorations around the country and the world. They were traveling either alone or in groups of other women, no men. They were waiting longer and longer to get married because they were having fun. And I think that that's, you know, I think that that's a really important thing to acknowledge.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf, and we're talking with Julia Cook. She's the author of Come Fly the World, the Jet Age Story of the Women of Pan Am.
Why did it end? I mean, why are we in the era of the flight attendant and no more stewardesses? What happened to end it?
Well, men began to be hired in the early 70s, as well they should have been. Again, the dismantling of the sexist labor policies was a good thing. On the whole. So men began to be hired, and so they needed a more gender neutral and not as laden with, you know, that pop cultural image title. So that's when flight attendants became the norm.
Julia Cook, what led you to write this book in the first place? How did you fall into this?
Yeah, I met two women. I had gone to an event. So my dad worked for Pan Am until I was 9 when the airline went under. And so, you know, it had always been, a thing in the back of my mind that, you know, Pan Am, it looms large in my childhood. We traveled a ton when I was a kid, but I really hadn't thought that much about the airline itself until I saw that the Pan Am Historical Foundation was going to be hosting an event at the TWA terminal in JFK in New York. Which is an incredibly beautiful structure. It's incredible. So gorgeous. It was designed by Eero Saarinen in the 50s. It's absolutely stunning. And I really had always just wanted to go tour the building. So I went to this event and I met these two former stewardesses who, you know, their bearing really struck me as almost revolutionary. They were both sophisticated and savvy, glamorous and gritty, knowledgeable, but also really polished. And they seemed to have anticipated various movements. You know, they seemed like, you know, third wave feminists, you know, wearing heels and lipstick while receiving paychecks and traveling without their husbands or chaperones, you know, even though they were doing it right in the thick of the second wave of feminism. They talked about shopping around the world in a way that to me sounded like the globalized marketplaces of today. And they talked about international relations with this awareness of diplomacy and power and history. And they seemed to have acted in a way that I think we would today call public diplomacy, which was, you know, only starting to be acknowledged back then.
Yeah, you mentioned the terminals that they built at JFK and at Los Angeles International Airport also, that I can also remember, you know, that when you just came out of the terminal on the and you walked across the tarmac and you climbed up these stairs to get into the plane, not like now where you go through that little tube and you're not exposed to anything outside. What was behind? I mean, why did they build those enormous terminals? Were they flush with cash? What was behind it all?
You know, part of it was this sense of trying to cultivate or to build up their images. A lot of it was, you know, the airlines were ascendant and they were so intertwined with this notion of American, you know, American industrialism and expansion around the globe. And, you know, the airports and their terminals, that was, you know, the first physical iteration of them.
My wife told me when I was reading this book that she used to go when she was a little girl to the New York World's Fair of 64 and 65, and that there were a million stewardesses there all the time. That I guess there was a Pan Am, a pavilion and a PWA pavilion, and there were stewardesses all over the place.
Yeah, they really took very seriously this concept that that their stewardesses were representations of America. That was, you know, this is not necessarily true of every airline. You know, every airline, it's true of every airline that they invested in image and in, you know, the physical infrastructure as a way of, you know, telling the country who they were and selling their product. But for Pan Am in particular, they were not only selling their product in the US, but all around the world. And they really took very seriously this concept that they represented American interests abroad, that they represented capitalism. This was the height of the Cold War. And so they were representing, you know, the whole capitalist way of life. And they were representing, you know, the future almost.
I when I was a kid, I never thought that certain brands or products would ever disappear. You know, there'll always be Hershey bars and Kleenex and Pan Am and TWA. And yet those things are gone. What, why did Pan Am fold? What happened?
So my dad, who worked for Pan Am, will point out that none of the, or rather very few of the trunk airlines back then still exist. So clearly it was not just Pan Am, you know, it's a really hard industry to make a good profit in. There's a reason why in most countries they have a flag carrier. That's the term for an airline that's, you know, connected with the government and subsidized. Uh-huh. Yeah, exactly. They're subsidized. And we don't have that here. So, you know, it's a really hard industry. My research led me to think that a lot of it had to do with the 747, which Pan Am invested hugely in the 60s, like hugely. And it came out and started flying in the early 70s at just the wrong time. You know, deregulation was about to happen. And so it's going to get ever harder to fill those huge planes. They'd made a huge, huge investment. And, you know, there was also the costs of fuel was only getting more expensive. So it was just kind of one, you know, Pan Am had prided itself on being an airline of firsts, which it really was all throughout the 20th century. But that was kind of just one first too many.
The 747s, they had a spiral staircase that led up to a bar, a piano bar.
Exactly. Yeah. And the piano bar for a while, there's this great, I think it's Calvin Trillin in The New Yorker, wrote a great piece about flying from New York to L.A. and how the 747 bar between New York and L.A. was the coolest, you know, bar scene or lounge scene in the country.
Well, so you've written about Cuba and you've written about the world of stewardesses. What are you going to do next, Julia?
I have a book that I'm working on. It has to do with women who traveled a lot, but it's very different. And that's all I really can say because it's not confirmed yet. I had hoped to have something to be able to talk about, but I don't.
Well, this book it's so wonderful. I really, really love it.
I'm so glad.
Come Fly the World, the Jet Age Story of the Women of Pan Am, and the author, my guest, the brilliant Julia Cook. Thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Julia Cook, author of Come Fly the World, the Jet Age Story of the Women of Pan Am. Joining me now is artist and educator Robin Smith. She is the founder of Print Day in May, which is coming up on May 1st. Robin Smith, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you, Gary. Glad to be here.
So tell us again, what is Print Day in May?
Print Day in May is an annual celebration of creativity, community, and printmaking, art. It is a day once a year, the first Saturday in May. It's been going on since 2007, when artists and printmakers, people all over the world who are interested in art and print, make a print somewhere, somehow, and they post it on our social media sites, and they instantly join a community of tens of thousands of printmakers, all printing at the same time within the same 24-hour period all across the globe. We have about 73-74 countries represented this year, and literally thousands and thousands and thousands of artists participating.
Oh, it sounds like so much fun. How did this get started, Robin?
It began a number of years ago, 2007, just a bunch of people. I was teaching at Monterey Peninsula College, and a bunch of my students wanted to all print together one Saturday And people had various presses in different parts of Santa Cruz County and Monterey County. So we all invited a few people over, we printed, and we didn't really deal with social media so much back then. We kind of called each other on the phone and said, "I'm drinking champagne. How about you?" and since then it's grown.
And you have people from all over America.
Yes, we have all 50 U.S. states. We've had all 50 states for probably 5 years now. And then we began to really concentrate more internationally and try to rack up the countries. That's kind of my fun part of this, is just imagining people all over the globe and however many countries we can get. So that's really exciting for me. And many countries, there are, you know, thousands of people in, you know, all printing in various ways. I mean, you can make a footprint in the sand, you can finish an edition that's going to the Library of Congress, you can, you know, and anything in between.
And you're in all seven continents.
Yes, because we had penguin footprints sent to us, and they are part of the Antarctica archive of Print Day in May.
That's funny. So tell me, how can people participate in Print Day in May?
There are many ways to do it. If you are on Facebook or Instagram, you can find us at either of those social media sites, and you can simply upload pictures of things that you make on that day, or processes that you're involved with. Tag us. You'll immediately get seen by all of our social media. We have sponsors. So if you go to our website, www.printdayinmay.com, you will see all kinds of information. And there are specific hashtags that you can use to up when you upload your images. And then the sponsors will give you prizes. They'll choose from all of their hashtagged participants. You can also go to our website and register. Again, printdayinmay.com. Just go to registration, and that gets you newsletters, and it gets your name on the page, and it allows us to really solidly count you as a Print Day in May participant. And this year, we are putting together a juried exhibition, the best of Print Day in May 2020-2021, called Traces of Print Day in May. So if you really want to get involved, you can submit your work for jurying. We have three international jurors of great renown. And the winners, the people who are, the work that is selected for this exhibition will be up on our website through the summer of 2021. And you'll get your work in front of these three really important printmakers.
Well, so aside from the Traces art show, art exhibition, how much does it cost for someone to register for Print Day in May and become part of
the— Oh, nothing. It's completely free.
Oh.
It's all— oh, I should have mentioned that initially. No, this is not— there's no money involved. It's just people making art, printing together, learning something new, having a good time, and celebrating it around the world.
And where will you be? Will you be printing?
Yes, I always do. And this year I will again be at Blue Mouse Studios in Aptos, California. That is Print Day in May Central. Once I retired from Monterey Peninsula College, the event migrated with me to Blue Mouse Studio. And last year I was alone like everybody else. But this year I'm going to have a few friends over, and I'm going to rechristen the studio that has not seen any other human beings since last March. So it's very exciting.
It's very exciting. And will you be broadcasting, streaming, I guess is the word. Will you be streaming video from Blue Mouse Studios, Robin?
I will be continuously putting things up on YouTube. I think I'm supposed to learn how to do Facebook Live. So perhaps my engineer can help me with that this year.
I don't have that button.
Yeah. And yeah, we'll see what we can do.
So Print Day in May, the first Saturday in May for the last how many years?
Well, can you do the math? Since 2007.
That's a long time.
That's a long time. It started off with 12 people, and I think we've got, we've got at least 12,000, probably a whole lot more than that.
Well, that's wonderful. Well, good luck with Print Day in May, Robin Smith, and thank you for visiting with us again on From the Bookshelf.
Thanks very much, Gary.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.